Welcome, spooks and creeps, to our assortment of devilry. We will question your reality, tug at the taboo, and follow the white rabbit into the abyss. Leave sanity at the door and only bring superstitions, for now you're in the hands of our host. Enjoy the show. Thank you, spooks, creeps, and freaks, for joining us again for another episode. Tonight, we have a very special guest, and I'm really excited because it is Women's History Month this March, and someone who's done amazing contributions to women in the field of paranormal, whether it be research or investigation or just giving women a voice. Here with us tonight, we have Alex Matsuo. Welcome.
Hey, Cody, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so, wow, just to mention, trying to like get everything that you do into one sentence, and I brought up your bio because I was like, I can't write all this down. So you are the founder of the Association of Paranormal Study, which you still run, and you just literally came off a meeting to join us tonight, and you were also featured in Haunted Hospitals, which I just made my wife watch that episode. I watched your episode probably 5 or 6 times because it's the one episode that probably has stuck with me the most out of all the ones I've watched. And then I found out just by having the most terrifying places in America on in the background, I was like, I recognize that voice. And I look over and I was like, oh, there you are on the screen. And I was just, I had a project going on. I like to put any paranormal shows like my background noise. But whenever I heard you talking about it, I was like, oh yeah, look at that.
And, I know her.
I know her. You are also the host of The Spooky Stuff, which was, to me, an amazing podcast. I listened, I binged 3 episodes in the past few days. I thought they were just phenomenal. I did the Amanda Wormer, who she's great. Then I did Ken, and I did Shane. And I got to say, I don't know if I just happened to hit like maybe your 3 best episodes or all your episodes are just that good, but they really were amazing and impactful interviews.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I actually have 2 interviews that I never publish, but I keep trying to publish them, but it's like the whole editing thing that, you know, gets in the way.
Oh my gosh.
Like I need to hire like a freelance editor to work to make those episodes for me because I want to get those interviews out. But yeah, no, that's a lot of people really enjoyed that podcast, and I didn't really realize it until like really years later. Like I still have those episodes up on Spotify or wherever you enjoy your podcasts. And yeah, I mean, I got to meet a lot of really cool people. I got to, you know, interview and really shed some light and build awareness of really at the end of the day, marginalized people in the field who often don't get that spotlight or don't get the attention that they should get because maybe they don't fit the conventional demographic of who a paranormal person is. I mean, luckily in recent years, paranormal media especially is becoming more inclusive. One of the documentaries I was a part of on Tubi, Scariest Places in the World, had a very diverse lineup of experts. I was very happy. I actually didn't really know who were like the fellow experts that would speak on camera until after I watched it, but I was like, oh, nice, you know. So things are getting better. Things are getting better, and ideally it would be one of those like, oh, maybe the podcast won't be needed anymore because then, you know, there will be equal exposure, equality, and evenness with diversity, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I like that you brought to the forefront about, you know, women in the paranormal. I've always been a firm believer that women, I mean, I'm not just being biased towards women, but they've always seemed to get the best evidence. They're more sensitive to the paranormal. I think that's almost a fact by now. And then, of course, if you ever watch any of these documentaries or read any stories, it's usually the woman that senses the, you know, paranormal activity first or starts having the interaction. And then the men's, you know, the man or husband of the house is usually like the disbeliever and then mm-hmm. doesn't really do anything until he actually sees, you know, a book fly across the room.
Yep.
So
yep.
I always found that fascinating. And I was like, you know, she's right. It's like women really should be more in the forefront because they're the ones that's There are, I think, way more female investigators than there are male, and they're just not getting a big enough voice. And hopefully that is changing for the better, especially with a lot of these new, not new, but some of these personalities that have been around that are getting, more recognition, like yourself. I think Morgan Knudsen's another one that comes to mind. She's
Love her.
very educated and yeah, very well read. She just everything that comes out of her, I'm just like, oh. And then another writer who's also on the feminine macabre, Heather Mosier.
Oh, yeah, I love
Really good
Heather.
work.
She's on my team too.
Oh, is she really? Okay, I didn't know that. I remember I watched a live of her doing, I think she was at Mansfield Reformatory. Yeah. And I know she does all the stuff with Small Town Monsters, and she comes on the show every once in a while, and we like to give her a hard time.
Nice. She recently joined a big thing my team has recently done, and we're pivoting towards a model where basically anybody can join nationwide. So it's more of like an organization of like ethics and protocols and procedures, where we're trying and also trying to support researchers. So if we have monthly dues, and ideally once we get enough membership to support the organization beyond keeping the lights on, we want to be able to offer like Ancestry memberships, newspapers.com memberships that are sponsored by the organization, research resources. And actually, Heather is the ideal member, because it's like, hey, you're doing all this really great stuff. This is our way of helping you. And then in exchange, you're part of the team, and we're very much, educating, empowering the community. So Heather, I'm thrilled to have Heather on the team, especially with her expertise in cryptozoology, because that is something that the team has always lacked. So being able to support that and have her be a part of that is truly, it's truly an honor. So yeah, that's it's she's pretty fantastic. There's a lot of really fantastic women that are doing such great things. One woman I met this past, well, not this year, but last year, is Lauren Hellickson. I think I'm saying her name right. She builds tech, and she makes these crystal pods that are like almost like REM pods, but they're different. But she can explain how the technology works, how it works in relation to like the paranormal, but also she exercises skepticism, and she does welcome skeptics to review her tools, which you never see that. Usually it's a skeptic like Kenny Bill saying, oh yeah, I got this from a friend of a friend, and I'm going to take it apart now. And Lauren's like, no, here, poke the holes, let me know where the gaps are, which is very impressive. So she's another one that she's one that I met this past year that I'm like, oh yeah, whatever you need, let me know what you need, because you're amazing. You would never know that with the way paranormal media is. I mean, even some of the even a lot of the women that are in TV, they still have a male co-host. Like, we don't get to see a woman leading a show as an investigator. When, oh gosh, the Hulu show that came out last year, 2 years ago, Repossessed, that actually has the cast of two women and one male, but the male is still the leading person. And it's like, you have two women, it's like, we were this close. So close. But they were like, one was the medium and the other was like the historian. I would love to see a show where there's a woman who is the forefront, the lead investigator. The investigator, not the witch, not the psychic, not the historian. I mean, those are all important roles, but to have the protagonist of the show as a woman and as a lead investigator, I think would be game changing in the industry, and have it network supported. So network TV like Discovery Plus, Travel Channel, A&E, History Channel, those though that network level I think would be huge. And I don't think we're too far away from it. I think it's on the horizon.
Yeah, you had me thinking, and the only one I can think I've actually watched who was a lead investigator, I would say would be Kitsi Duncan. I mean,
Oh, Kitsy, I love Kitsy. Yes.
she had her show. Goodness gracious, it's been so long since I've watched her, but she ran that one pretty well.
She did. It wasn't network supported though. That's the
No.
only thing. It wasn't network supported. A lot of the indie stuff is actually a lot better than the network stuff. I'll just say that. Like Kitsy's show was really good. And I think with the rise of like YouTube, I mean, YouTube's always been a thing, but I think with more shows like Katrina and Heather Taddy, Katrina Weidman and Heather Taddy, you know, they have Travel the Dead on YouTube.
Oh, okay. I've followed them, gosh, in Paranormal State and
Yeah. It's so after I want to say Portals to Hell was canceled, I think Heather and Katrina basically said, you know what, let's just go to YouTube. Yeah, so they got that going. And that one's actually pretty, that's actually really good. And it's still like paranormal TV-esque, you know, with the genre and everything, but I feel like there's a lot more to it now that it is indie and there's no like, I guess, input from producers or networks to change the narrative or to make it scarier. Because that is a thing as somebody who has been on TV a couple times, you know, there's like that, oh yeah, that's great. Can you make it scarier? Make it more dramatic, look more traumatized. That was probably my favorite direction that I got on a show was look more traumatized.
Look more
And I'm
traumatized.
like, sorry, 15 years of self-deprecating humor and Dunkin' Donuts have kind of made this what you see right now. So I'll try.
And what's their show called again?
Travel the Dead.
Travel the Dead. I'm going to look that up because I've been such a fan of both of them. And I was always wondered, like, Portals to Hell. And I think they even did that Haunted Highways years ago.
Yeah.
And I was always like, how come Jack Osborne's the lead investigator when you have the two actual people who've been doing the paranormal investigating since their early college days are right there? But I guess because he's Jack Osborne, so.
Yeah, I mean he's got yeah, he's Jack Osborne. That makes it tough.
We're going to get into the meat of this, and everybody, or most people that get into the paranormal field usually get in because they had an early childhood experience or something that they couldn't explain that just left questions in their mind. And if they went to an adult and asked about it, they would usually say, I don't know, or forget it, or don't ever talk about it. What was your first experience?
Okay, that's a good question. Yeah, so at least the earliest experience I can remember, I was about, I say around between 7 through 9. And it's ambiguous because it was so long ago. I know it was about a year or so after my grandfather died, so that probably would have put me more around the age 7 or 8 range. But so my grandmother was originally from Appalachian, Kentucky, specifically the tri-state area of Kentucky. So literally, all right on the edge, you go across one bridge, you're in Ohio. You go across the other bridge, you're in West Virginia. That area, that town is also about 45 minutes away from Point Pleasant. And I would spend my summers when I wasn't with my dad in San Francisco, I was spending my summers in Kentucky in this little town. And being a California kid, you know, it was a completely different world for me. And I remember, this is so cliche, but it was a dark and stormy night. It was a dark and stormy night. The Ohio River was maybe a mile away from my mama's house. And of course, again, San Diego kid, California kid, I had never really seen rain before, you know, or if I do see rain, it's like trickle, 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 not this like blowing sideways thunderstorm, like dramatic storm. I don't see that often. So of course I'm looking outside and watching it and just going like, holy cow, you know? And I looked outside and I saw this hooded figure on my mamaw's property, like standing on a hill, on a fairly steep hill, and it's completely this figure is completely unbothered by the weather. Its robes weren't even like flapping in the wind. You know, I got to figure out a better way to say flapping in the wind because yeah, it's funny. to me, it's funny, and I thought that was weird. Initially, I thought, well, maybe it's one of my cousins. Well, technically, my mom's cousins. And I'm like, okay, that's still weird. And so I close the curtain, I open the curtain, and the figure is now closer to the house. And I'm like, okay.
Oh,
So
no.
I close the curtains again. I'm like, but then curiosity got the best of me. I open the curtains and the figure is even closer to the window. I finally get the hint that maybe I should stop opening up the curtains and looking out the window. So I run to the bed again. Mama, Appalachia, Kentucky, in a 1, 2, 3, 4 bedroom house, one bathroom, like house that's barely standing. It's literally on bricks. It's not a trailer, but it's definitely a lower. It's not like accommodations were very minimal. The bed I was sleeping on, the mattress was so light and firm that if I sat on the mattress, it tipped. And so I had to get into bed strategically so I didn't fall off the bed. But once I'm there, I'm good. I also shared the bed with my mamaw when we visit. So whenever mamaw got into bed, the bed would tip and I would slide down and I would hit, you know, I would, she would stop. She would stop me from falling off the bed. So after I see the hooded figure, I run to bed, get into bed, and I'm laying there. And then I heard footsteps and the bed tipped. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah, Mama, Mama's coming to bed. I slid completely off the bed. I hit the floor. I look up at the bed. The bed is still tilted, which the only way that could happen is if someone is sitting on it. And so I look up, the bed is still tilted, and maybe like a couple seconds later, the bed just goes back in place, like little squeak and everything went back into place. And half of me was like terrified, and then the other half of me was like, oh, that's really cool. So like I was scared, but I was like, oh, okay, that's really cool. I want to know more. So that was my earliest experience that I could remember. I had a couple more experiences after that. Like I was doing theater, so I saw like an apparition of a ballet dancer at this one theater I was doing shows at. The story behind her was she was the ingenue, the lead of the ballet, and her jealous understudy tripped her and she fell down the stairs and died. I saw her and she disappeared in front of me. Yeah, so I had a couple experiences growing up.
Man, always the understudy. They're always out to
It's
get you.
always you got to watch out for those understudies.
Yikes. And how old were you when you saw the ballet dancer?
Oh, I want to say I was, 'cause at that point I was 7th grade middle school, so probably like 12 or 13, I think.
Yeah.
I remember what show it was. I just have to remember what year I did that show. It was Peter Pan. I was doing Peter Pan. And some people did try to debunk that story of like, oh, what if it was like one of your castmates? And I'm like, okay, for one, the way the theater works, you know, we were at places, you're in your costume to ready to start the show. This person was not in her costume. She was in a leotard and tights. And also, when you rent a theater, no one else is in there. It's not like anybody can just walk into that theater and be like, oh, yeah, you know, I'm just going to be in my ballet gear and stretch, you know, right before a show's happening. That's not how this works. And plus, when you're in a show, you spend a lot of time with people for about 2, 3 months. So, you know, if you don't know their names, you know the faces. And I
Yeah.
did not know this person. So I'm like, riddle me that, you know?
That is fascinating. I guess one question I have about the hooded figure, did you ever ask your mamaw who the hooded figure was?
Okay. So remember Appalachia, Kentucky. If you
We're
heard
calling them.
something,
Yeah.
no, you didn't. If you
Oh.
see something, no, you didn't. So, okay, so there was an acknowledgement that, yeah, you did see something. So the other thing that would happen at my mamaw's at night, and I honestly thought she was just messing with me, but sometimes I wonder if there was more to it. At once the sun set, it was, because my name was Alexandra, but my Kentucky family called me Xander. They're like, Xander, once the sun sets, you need to go straight home. Like, you need to go home. And this was a summer of when I woke up, I ate breakfast, and then I was out. I was out. I was playing. I was in the woods, like with the local kids. So I wasn't completely by myself. But once the sun started to set, you need to get home. Like, get home as soon as you can. We did have neighbors who were at the bottom of the hill. But other than that, I mean, everybody was probably about a good quarter mile, half a mile apart from each other, at least. And at night, there would be like this scratching on the walls or on the outside of the house, like scratching, banging, thumping. And my mama would say, "You better pray, child. That's the devil trying to get in."
Jeez, come on.
Yeah, I know, right? And so I'm sitting here like, okay, so on this property, my great uncle and his wife also lived. So it was just like maybe, I want to say, by maybe 250 feet away. So I'm like, oh, it could have been Uncle Glenn, walking down and like messing with me. But I would look outside and I wouldn't see him walking because, I'm curious. I'm looking outside to see what's going on. But yeah, so but she would say things like that, like, that's the devil trying to get in. You better pray, child. And I'm like, okay. So there was an acknowledgement. I did take photos of my mamaw's house is still standing. There's no one living in it anymore. My great uncle passed away, but his wife and my mom's cousin still live on the property. The house is still there. I don't know why they haven't bulldozed it, but it's still standing. I don't know if there's like hopes of renovating it, but you basically can't walk in it now because you'll fall through the floors. But the house is still standing. So I took pictures of the house, and there's a walkway behind the house. And I sent it to a couple of medium friends. I didn't tell them the context of the house. I just said, hey, let me know what you pick up, if there's anything you pick up from this. And one of them got back to me and said that she was sensing, because she asked if there was a river nearby. And I'm thinking, like, yeah, it's the Ohio, like the Ohio River. The Ohio River is not a small river. That's like, it's a huge river. And she's like, I'm picking up something from the river. Like, it's a man in like a hood, like in a hood or a poncho, a dark poncho. He roams and walks around that house at night. And I'm like, okay. And I'm like, okay. Thank you. So I'm like, thanks. It was when she said the poncho or like a hood or like some sort of thing, like what fishermen would wear, when they're going out to sea or they're out on the boat. And I'm like, huh. Okay. Interesting. So yeah. And my mamaw had some wonderful, well, why I say wonderful, but a lot of stories related to like folklore and Appalachia, but also some really just downright weird stories that would happen in the family. That there was a set of twins in our extended family, one twin unalive, the other twin, and when the night that happened, the moon was blood red. And it's like, what? And my mom was telling me when my great grandfather died, as he was slip or as he was starting the dying process, there was a light that started at the bottom of the hill, and the closer he was getting to death, the bigger that light grew. Eventually, that this light, she said, was so big and brilliant and bright, when he passed, that light just lifted off of the ground and floated away. And people saw that, people saw that and attested to it. And I'm like, okay, just some really interesting stories like to come from that area. And then after my mom actually passed not too far from that house because she ended up in that town at the end of her life. And I had some weird stories. I had some weird experiences in her house too, as I was trying to process her death. Like all the electronics that were unplugged because we were going through her house, all turned on, from radios to like appliances were turning on as I was like, once that started to happen, I tried to communicate with her, and it was wild. It was so that there's something about that area that, and it's not even like beyond just Appalachia. There's something about that area, about that town, because like I said, Mothman, Point Pleasant, 45 minutes away. It's not far. It's not far at all. There's just something weird. There's something weird over there.
Yeah, that's I would say so. Because there's just so much. I know Steve Stockton wrote a book about it. So did Mark Buncey, did the Eerie Appalachia. Yeah, it's not even like just ghosts, but it's just like a lot of weird stories and weird happenings that I guess, to some people it's almost commonplace. Like your mamaw is just used to it.
Literally anything I was saying to them, no, nobody was surprised. Like nobody was shocked, and they're just like, yeah, nah. just don't, if you think your mom is calling you in the woods, no, she's not. Just come home.
Oh
Come,
man,
it's like,
I
Xander,
mean,
you come straight home and tell me about it. And that was it. Anytime I wanted to ask more, it was just like, nope. Another thing though about that town is all of the churches are oddly close together. So once you get into town, you have your I use this very gener this word generously. You have your downtown area. I guess your main street area. I guess that would be a better way to word it. But there would be an area where all the churches were, and it was literally like I mentioned the houses, they're all like half a mile or more apart from each other, the churches were literally like inches apart from each other. Independent buildings, but they were all squished together. And there were several Pentecostal churches. And then my family went to a Free Will Baptist church. And Free Will Baptists are cousins to Pentecostals because there's the speaking in tongues. It gets, I don't want to say weird because I don't want to marginalize that area of faith, but it's very, I mean, because Pentecostals are a whole different level of Christian. Like it's a whole like, there's a mystical side to it, and Free Will Baptists are very similar. And my family, they're Free Will Baptists, so I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but it's there's just something like I. And that's actually why I loved Deep South Paranormal because I was like, hey, you know, it's like this is stuff that I know about. Like, they're Christian, but they have like occult practices that they've integrated into Christianity, which is fascinating. So I don't know if that has anything to do with it or the lore of it all, but it's wild. It's wild. I go back to that area occasionally. Unfortunately, it's been more for funerals than to just visit. I'm trying to change that because, you know, the last batch of people who knew my grandparents are dying, and I'm trying to get stories from them. So, yeah.
Oh wow, that's fascinating. Because I've been trying to get doing the same thing with like my grandparents are trying to get stories from the generation that grew up around them. I'm trying to get that before they're gone because it gets lost with time.
Yep, absolutely.
Speaking of that, you have volume one of the Women of Paranormal, A Brief History. You're coming out with volume two soon, right? Or is it's
Yeah, it's definitely going to be this year.
I was gonna say, I don't want to say that it's out yet, but I think I've seen you put a cover or something out for it, right? Or has that
Oh,
been done yet?
not yet. I actually have
Okay.
to talk to my cover artist. Yeah, so I did get a book deal with the History Press for a book about haunted Northern Virginia, which is where I live now. So
Okay.
that kind of delayed Women of the Paranormal a little bit because History Press wants to get this book out by the fall. So I was like, oh, that deadline's coming up quick. So I'm hoping in a perfect world, in a perfect world, I would have it out in June. What's probably going to more so happen is either going to be maybe August. July or August, because the Haunted Northern Virginia book is coming out in September, and I'm trying to be cognizant of how I stagger my book releases. But you never know. After I'm done with this book on Haunted Northern Virginia, I could get a fire lit under my butt and get Women of the Paranormal done. I did kind of put it out there to Twitter, because volume one is about 70,000 words. I did put a thing out to Twitter or X, and I was like, hey, would it be terrible if like volume two was like 60,000 words instead? And nobody cared. They were like, just do what you need to do. So, but you know, it's that whole childhood trauma and getting over like having to get acceptance from everybody, you know, talking to my therapist about that. Hypothetically, like I said, if I get a fire lit under my butt after I submit the manuscript for the Virginia book, I could have it out by June because I have an editor who works pretty quickly. And she, because she knows my writing, she knows my writing, she knows my cadence, and she also edited volume one. So it's like she knows it. Could also do a thing where I send her what I have right now, and then she edits it, and then you know, then I send her the rest. I don't want to do that until I'm at least halfway into the book, which I'm about there. Yeah, so that was a very long answer to what should have been a short answer, but yeah, so this year, sometime this year.
Oh, that's perfect. And going back to this amazing history. I mean, you go back to Catherine Crowe, like 1850s, right?
Yep. Actually, I think even 18 early earlier than that, 1814. I'm trying to remember when she passed. No,
But
1850s, because it was right after, a little bit after the Fox sisters. Or yeah, it was about the same time. Yeah, about the same time.
yeah. And not a lot of people know about her and about her contribution to the paranormal research world. What's one thing about her that really stuck with you that she contributed?
You know, I think there's a couple. One, the fact that she brought the word doppelganger and poltergeist into English usage. And those are probably some of the biggest buzzwords of the paranormal today. Maybe not buzzwords, maybe that's the wrong word. But also the fact that she was already doing like what we would consider a modern paranormal investigation. Myself, others like Amanda Woomer, this is the hill that we will die on, that she was the first ghost hunter. Other people will try to say, like, well, what about Athena Doris? And one, Athena Doris was likely more of a myth, because this was a story relayed by Pliny the Younger, telling a story about this. At least that incident with Athena Doris is more so like of folklore, teaching a lesson, which a lot of the stories back then were doing. But also, I've had people come at me and say, well, what about priests? And I'm like, but they're not ghost hunting. An exorcism is not a ghost hunt. At least, like there was people literally using a bullwhip to exorcise demons out of people. That's not the same. Like Catherine Crowe was actually like going to a location, bringing in a psychic medium, not telling the psychic medium why they're there, doing research. She pretty much conducted what we would consider to be a ghost hunt. And that work that she did ended up really setting the foundation for what would later become the Society for Psychical Research. She didn't jump to conclusions after The Night Side of Nature came out, which I think was 1848, some one of those years, because I know the Fox sisters, and that was also 1848. But she was collecting stories and letters, and people would reach out to her and say, hey, what do you think about this thing happening in my house? And can you come over and help me? And she did. So she was kind of like the Grant and Jason of the Victorian era, back then, or at least of Victorian Edinburgh. And the fact that her legacy got so derailed by Charles Dickens, who really lives up to the legacy of his last name, is also infuriating. The short version of that story is there was speculation that Catherine, in her later years, was seen naked out in the streets of Edinburgh with a handkerchief in one hand and I think it was a bus pass or something in the other. And she thought that the spirits had rendered her invisible. So she was seen naked out on the streets, and then she was put into an asylum, and none of that happened. The United Kingdom released their patient records from the asylums dating, I think they go as far back as the 1700s. There was no Catherine Crowe in any of those records. So even if she was sent to an asylum, she wasn't admitted. And then the asylum that they said that she was put in was in London. And she was living in Edinburgh at the time. But, I mean, we see how misinformation and false information can spread so quickly in our modern day. In Catherine's case, it was spreading in London. And she was in Edinburgh and she had no idea like this was all being said about her until she went to visit. So she went to London to visit and found out. And she actually ended up writing to all the papers saying, hey, I understand you ran this story about me. I was sick at the time. I had a fever and I have no memory of any such incident. Can you please correct this? Which is heartbreaking. It was heartbreaking to read that. It's like, wow, this woman's life kind of got ruined. And there was a lot of nuance to that whole situation, too, because Catherine Crowe was a spiritualist, Charles Dickens was a mesmerist. Mesmerists and spiritualists did not get along. And in fact, they were always, but I think especially with the mesmerists, always looking to discredit each other. And I think Catherine was a victim of that. I am glad she's getting exposure now. I'm glad that more people are aware of her. It's odd though, sometimes how some people will go to extreme extents to devalue her work. I mean, Amanda Woomer got banned from a haunted location for saying Catherine Crowe was the first ghost hunter.
Wow, I
Like
didn't
somebody
know
was
that.
that invested in that they banned Amanda from a location, which is wild. But I think that's also a demonstration of the level of misogyny that we still experience today. And actually, I don't necessarily experience it like, what's a good word to explain it? Because I have a gender neutral first name. Many people, if they don't know who I am, they automatically assume I'm male. And I have noticed once it's discovered I'm female, just I've noticed how differently I'm treated. Especially if I'm on Facebook and I have a picture with my husband, people will assume that Alex is my husband, or my husband is Alex. I'll get called brother and I'll get like, oh yeah, let's collaborate, let's work together, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, great. And then it's like, oh yeah, thanks, brother. And I'm like, no, I'm not a brother. I'm not a brother. I go my I'm a she. Well, my pronouns are she, they. But it's like I'm this person, and then like it just changes. It's a switch. I'm like, okay, great. I guess we're not going further with this. Cool.
So you mentioned the spiritualist movement. It's definitely kind of, if you look at the movement itself, it's been, it had its popularity, I guess it started, wow, geez, I would probably think maybe the 1860s, 1870s, they actually started making spirit boards and started doing the seances, and it kind of grew and grew and grew. And you had all these great, interesting characters that kind of came along and went in and out of it, Aleister Crowley being one. But in the end, with what was going on, is really people trying to make contact with the past loved one, because you had a lot of death going on at the time. You had the Civil War here in America, you had different wars across the planet. Of course, the British Empire was always sending people off to go Africa, India, and go do wars over there. So it was really kind of a European American phenomenon. It's, to me, it's pretty much still in practice whenever you consider what paranormal research and paranormal investigation is, and people trying to make contact with a loved one. One that always comes to mind was Gary Gawka, making all these great devices. And then you learn the backstory of it was he's trying to reach his daughter, who tragically died young. But out of everything that's come with this, and it, kind of came up, and then we went back, and Christianity would try to squash it. Are there any practices that you've learned through your research that you find that it's helpful in today's paranormal investigation?
That's a good question. Yeah, actually. So there was a woman, her name is Gertrude Schmiedler. She was a parapsychologist from 70s, 80s era. She came up with a couple of methods that I use today. Well, one that I really use today. So she came up with the sheep goat experiment, and that experiment, it consists of, because she was on the parapsychology side, so it's belief in psi or to having psi abilities. And she found that, so she put people in two different categories, sheep and goat. Sheep were believers in psi, or they believed they had abilities in psi. Goat did not believe it. So she would do psi exercises, like the Zener cards and such, with both groups. And she found that the people who believed in psi had higher hits and higher accuracy than the people who identified as goats. So really puts into perspective of like seeing is believing type of concept. But the other thing that she did, and this is what I employ with my team, and this is something that I love, she did investigate hauntings. And what she would do was she would talk to the owners or talk to the residents, find out where like the activity was, where the hot spots were, remove the residents from the space, and then she would bring in a couple of different groups into the house, like psychics, mediums, skeptics, ghost hunters, and she would give them the floor plans of the house, and she would have them all mark the spots, that places where they thought it was haunted. And so then she would compare those notes between what the resident reported, what the psychics found, what the ghost hunters found, and what the skeptics found. And she would compare that data. And the big thing was, she would ask these people too, like, well, why did you choose that corner of the house? And she would find that unconscious bias does play in sometimes. Like we all have, like we've all probably been in a house where there's that one spooky room or that one creepy room or that creepy corner that you don't want to like go into. Like if it was darker or it was colder, like that may get marked as a hot spot. And that's actually something that I try to do with my team as much as possible when we go to locations, especially if we have a psychic medium who doesn't know the place. I'll make a, sometimes it's very poorly drawn, but I'll make a floor plan. And I'll have the mark like, hey, where have you felt something? Where do you have experiences? And sometimes it's really interesting to see what the mediums mark and then seeing if there's consistencies there. So that came from Gertrude Schmiedler.
Oh, that's very interesting. Sheep goat. I got that down. I'm gonna definitely look that up.
Yeah, she
So,
was a college professor too. I want to say at SUNY. I know she was a professor as well.
what was she like, parapsychology or just like psychology or?
Both. She delved into both. Okay, she taught at City College. Yes, City University of New York. Yeah, she was a experimental psychologist and parapsychologist.
There you go. She was a Ghostbuster.
She was. Yeah.
So what is your, I don't know if I want to say if it's your favorite method, but what is your maybe preferred method to yield the best results or get the most results during a paranormal investigation?
Ooh, that's a good question. It depends. I, as of late, because I've become really hyper aware of my own unconscious bias when I go into a location, I love to do the historical research beforehand because I like to know at least who I could be talking to and then be able to continue that conversation. If say like this like a house is haunted by Old Man Joe, and then I go and then I know about Old Man Joe's life, how he died and everything. I did notice though that if activity did happen, I would automatically say, "Oh, it's Old Man Joe." So it's like, well, maybe it's not. Maybe it's like Sally Sue from down the street who's coming to visit. You know, I don't know. So I try to be as broad as possible now with my investigations, at least with questions, to try to at least nowadays pinpoint who it is I could be talking to. I find that's more productive, and also sometimes just being quiet and letting them talk to us helps. And then we also open our investigations now with sharing our story, like our life story, because you never know. I mean, I have a couple of members of the LGBT community on my team. And so depending where we are, like I will have them take the lead, especially if there's a lot of queer history with the building. I mean, I'm queer too, but I'm not like, I still have privilege in that case. You know, I'm married to a male, and it's so for me, it's like I haven't gone through that sort of pushback on my lifestyle. I haven't actively encountered that in the same way as opposed to, you know, my team member who's trans, or, you know, my other team member who's male and married to another man. So, and I have found that that approach has actually been really effective. My two of my male team members had a very beautiful conversation with a spirit who may or may not have been queer at the Battleship North Carolina. It was a beautiful conversation about acceptance. It was all done through the Estes method. Ironically, I was the one that was under. I couldn't hear a
Cool.
thing that my team members were saying, and what sounded to me was like word salad from what I could remember. But then it when you listen to the conversation, it's very fluid. It's a lot of just trying to get some understanding of like, wait, men can marry each other now? Like, what? You know, it's just this whole like understanding and guiding that spirit through like, hey, this is how the world has changed since you were alive. So we really try to lead with empathy and lead with understanding and sharing our stories so that perhaps maybe there's a spirit out there that can relate to us or relate to one of us and better connect, as opposed to just coming in and saying, "Hey, my name's Alex. Make that little circle thing blink lights," you know, that kind of thing. I try to treat spirits more than just beeps and hits on a meter and words on an ovulus, because they're more than that. They're more than that. Like the other stuff is just like a byproduct of interacting, but I don't make that the focus. And we also don't react dramatically when the lights go off, like, whoa, we don't do that. I just go, huh, interesting.
So, and I think this was brought up there in your podcast. Can't remember if it was Ken or Shane. I think it was Ken that, yeah, that the spirit was definitely more open to the queer paranormal investigator because they recognized with them. But I guess in your mind, do you, because I don't know, we're all, as I think Steve Stockton put it one time, he's like, we're all just wandering kids, like blind in a forest, trying to find our way out whenever it comes to spirituality and the afterlife. In your belief, like, do you think that there was some, I mean, of course, back then, if it was, I'm guessing it was a battleship or something from World War II, and if you were a sailor on there, you more than likely did not mention that you were homosexual, and because you may be, of course, discriminated by it. So do you actually feel that the spirit was just more comfortable and more open to come out, and that they don't feel, I guess, and in the afterlife, gosh, I hope they don't feel like they're still, have that burden on them.
Yeah, I struggle a little bit with the idea that spirits are trapped in that turmoil, because one, I really hope that's not what the afterlife is, 'cause oof. But yeah, but I also I've talked to a couple of mediums about this too, 'cause Gettysburg's another place that comes to mind when it, with interacting with spirits and they're talking like they're still in the middle of the battle. And I'm just like, oh my God, I hope that I'm not trapped in that loop, like the worst day of my life. And it's just playing over and over and over again. Like I have to relive that constantly. Like I really hope that's not the case. I would like to believe that there is a certain level of consciousness and awareness, and then seeing someone, and maybe. Because I've also wondered too, like, do spirits evolve with us? Like would spirits from the 18th century that are hanging out today, would they know who the president is today? Or would they know like what a cell phone is? Because I feel like sometimes we treat them like they've been in a cloud this whole time. But I did listen to, it may have been on Jim Harold's podcast. I forgot who the guest was, but she had said something like spirits have short-term memory, so like they forget. Which I'm like, I need to see some sources, but okay. I mean, if we're all trying to figure this out. So I'm like, yeah, but I also go to locations where the spirits have gone, oh, hey, Alex, how are you? It's been a long time. So I'm like, yeah, that's not short-term memory loss. Like they remember. With that one spirit on the battleship North Carolina, considering that when there's a lot, when investigators do go to this place, it's very much like, oh, World War II. Pearl Harbor. The North Carolina was the first ship to arrive at Pearl Harbor after the attack. So it wasn't part of Pearl Harbor, in case any historians come for me. So it is connected with the attack of Pearl Harbor. They tend to go with that angle. Not saying that every team does, but that seems to be the trend that I see. So the fact that we were going with another angle and going with the more personal side with the investigation as opposed to an event-based side, maybe that's what prompted this spirit to want to talk to my team members. Yeah, I still think about that conversation to this day. I still think about it. I still wonder like what exactly is going on there. And oh my gosh, I hope that kid, because he was young, I hope that kid moved on to a better life, better afterlife, or reincarnated. Did something, I hope that that kid has peace, like for sure. And I really hope that's not, I hope we don't live in that after we die.
Yeah, that is we that'd be tough. And then I think about I think about your story, the one bed over story, with that particular gentleman, just so I guess angry and bitter that they had passed. And hopefully, yeah, he could move on with that and find some peace, because yeah, that wouldn't be fun. And I don't really have a theory on how time works with spirits, if it moves fast or if it moves slow, or if it's like that movie Ghost Story, I think that's what it's called, with Casey Affleck.
Oh, yeah.
That was a take I never even thought about, on the whole ghost thing. But yeah, that would be kind of depressing. But with all of your combined experience, knowledge, investigations, I'll just ask you point blank, what is a ghost?
Oh my gosh. Oh, I struggle with this because, we have like the whole ghost versus spirits terminology. I kind of use ghost and spirit interchangeably, but I do think that a ghost is leftover energy. I do have some theories about, well, and this is supported by East Asian philosophy too, that when we go through any sort of trauma, our soul kind of breaks apart and is pieces of it can be left behind, which could explain why a ghost could haunt multiple locations, honestly. Could be a theory, but I think a ghost is that leftover energy, it's that leftover consciousness, whether that's the complete consciousness of that person or it's just like a fragment of that person. That's really getting into the rabbit hole.
I mean, there really is no, I mean, no right answer. I guess we won't know until we're on the other side exactly what all that is. But yeah, no, I like to ask people that question, because everybody's got a kind of a different interpretation of what actually they're dealing with. And I tend to kind of agree with you about the whole energy thing, that energy isn't created or destroyed, it's just really transferred. And then of course, the power of thought as well. So definitely something's something's there and something's conscious enough to stay around and communicate with you. That's but no, thank you so much for that. I mean, I think that's it's probably about as good as an answer that we can get. But I'm not sure how we're doing on time. If you have time for one more question or if you need to get going.
I do.
Okay. I ask you something, but I think you might have already answered it, so I don't want to ask you again. So here's one, and this is a little bit controversial, but
Oh.
it kind of has to do with like tulpas, where we,
Ah, yes.
where you give life to. Basically, you had mentioned it in your podcast about that particular Waverly Hills. I think has been like y'all mentioned it had been investigated so many times that really not sure that. If it's the ghosts that were there, or if it's something that you completely created, and even like, so I myself have done some investigation with haunted dolls. One thing I noticed is that there's a Halloween store here that these two ladies own, and they had found a haunted doll at some garage sale that was like in a coffin, and her name's Sarah, and they can't get the coffin open, but they started noticing weird things happening around it, but they had purchased some other like just scary dolls. There's a scary doll maker that makes these dolls for I think Zach Bagans, and he puts them in his museum as like for decorations. But what they bought some and they put them in the shop, and then they started noticing weird things going on with these dolls. But it wasn't like these dolls were previously owned; they were brand new dolls. So I guess I want to get your opinion on: do you think that something could actually inhabit those dolls, or do you think that if someone wants something to be haunted or something to be an object to be possessed so much that, it almost becomes like a tulpa.
So I do believe in the power of you get what you put in, you get back. And I think the same comes when it comes to hauntings. And honestly, I do think, especially, because there's a lot of creators who I do have a couple of haunted dolls too. I don't pay them much attention anymore, just because when I was communicating with them, things would happen, especially when I first got Madison, who was the first haunted doll I got. But I do think that I sometimes some people want a something to be haunted so bad that they end up creating it. I'm actually dealing with that with a location that I'm very close to. After my book came out about this location, some people who do a lot of work with that area, with that location, started, I don't want to say they created new stories, but all these new ghosts started to pop up with different, like all these other ghosts with different names. And I'm like, how the hell did you find all these people? And I'm noticing that people, new investigators now, will have interactions with these new ghosts because they were told about them. And then it's like, oh yeah, it must be such and such. And then they'll get those names on their devices, and I'll try to, and I get told, like, hey, these people actually existed, and I'll look them up and I can't find them. So it's like, okay, so who's communicating with these ghost hunters then? And truly, I think it's because, like, when these stories get told over and over again, they kind of take on a life of their own. And I think when we give that acknowledgement to those stories, it just kind of inflates like a balloon a little bit. So, which just adds a whole level of muddiness and nuance to the paranormal too, because then it's like, well, am I actually talking to the spirit of Old Man Jim, or am I talking to the Old Man Jim that's been created by all these people who have visited the location over the last 10 years, So, which just complicates things then. Just complicates everything. But at the same time, it's like, if we have, my whole thing is, if we have the ability to do that with our mind, then it does validate that perhaps there is something more after our bodies are done.
Oh my gosh. Kind of makes you wonder. I mean, you could create something good, or you could create something out of like your nightmare, like what people are now are
Well,
like seeing Slenderman.
it's like the Philip experiment too, with that actual whole experiment that happened. Granted, they created a depressed Englishman. That was fairly low stakes once they stopped the experiment. And once you stop giving attention to whatever it is you created, theory suggests that it just dissipates. But yeah, but Slenderman, that's a great one. Slenderman, like, has become a thing. And by not just, like, and it's more than just feeding into a story, but also, like, teenagers and preteens who have an extraordinary amount of energy, who tend to manifest poltergeist-like activity anyway when their hormones are going nuts. So then you have that age group with all the hormones, all the energy, feeding into this lore that of this creature that not even that they're trying to manifest, but they think actually exists and needs their power or needs their energy. It's just like, oh my gosh, y'all, like y'all creating like Godzilla, but it's like Slenderman is Godzilla, you know?
Yeah, that's oh my gosh. And yeah, that's pretty wild. And it seems like those teenagers have a lot of energy. And I remember hearing somewhere where Ed Warren had said that all poltergeists are created by teenage girls. And
Which I guess he's not wrong, but it's like it's not that simple, but okay.
I guess that was just an easy one for him to go to back then. Oh, we got poltergeist. Well, are there any teenage girls in the house? Oh yeah. Okay, well there it is.
Yep.
Get the teenage girl out and your poltergeist problems are all gone. Okay. Is there anything you want to mention? Or I mean anything, I mean any, if there's anything that you would have liked me to ask or
No, I think you hit a lot of the good, you hit the good stuff, women in the paranormal love it. Yeah, no, I loved all your questions. So.
okay, well, excellent. So right now, I mean, I'd like to thank you so much for being on the show on the best 2.5 star podcast or paranormal podcast out there. You can go ahead and plug yourself, which ought to be pretty easy because you have the one website. But yeah, why don't you go ahead and give us the plug or give
Yeah.
yourself a plug. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so you can find me on Facebook, social media, TikTok, the spooky stuff. You can also get more information about me, my books, read my blogs at alexmatsuo.com. I got stuff on YouTube. I have stuff on TikTok and social media. I have Haunted Northern Virginia coming out this fall, and then hopefully Women of the Paranormal coming out sometime this summer.
Oh, that'd be
Volume
great.
two.
I can't wait. And you can find her on Tubi. That was also another show that I didn't realize that you were on until I heard that one in the background too. And I was like, oh yeah, there you
I'm
go.
everywhere.
You are literally everywhere. You give women such a big voice in the field of paranormal research. And we are all very, very grateful for all the hard work that you Thank
do.
you for joining
Thank you.
us.
Well,
We
thanks for
hope
having
your
me. This was a
journey
lot of
was
fun.
enlightening. Remember to click subscribe on your podcatcher of choice. If you are in need of more content, please visit us on social media, Spooks, Creeps, and Assorted Devilry, where we perform daily after miracles. If that's not enough, you can find Spooks, Creeps merchandise on Redbubble and Big Cartel. Until next time, be sure to wave your freak flag high, and we will find you.